So let's talk a little bit about hiring executives.
Yeah.
You know, you've made the decision to become an enterprise company. As you said, it's a very different, you know, go-to-market than a consumer company.
Yeah.
How did you go build out that muscle?
Yeah, so early on, got some great kind of early executive hires, our head of sales. We had a very rare situation where our head of sales was our first sales hire and took us to $100 million in revenue as our head of sales.
Wow.
So that's extremely
almost
rare.
Almost never happens.
Almost never happens. You usually have to, you know, kind of unfortunately, you know.
You were just a genius at hiring?
So genius. We had a Craigslist ad. The guy responded. And it was a very methodical process.
From Foundation Capital, this is How to B2B a CEO, the show about how to scale your enterprise startup and how to grow from founder to CEO. I'm Ashu Garg, general partner at Foundation Capital. So this is the second part of my two-part interview with Aaron Levy, founder and CEO of Box. If you haven't listened to the first part, you might want to go back and start there. In the first part, Aaron talked about his founding story, about raising money as a young founder, and about making the transition from a consumer to an enterprise company. In the second part, Aaron talks a lot about scaling to become a public company, how to build a great executive team, and how to build a culture, things that didn't come to him naturally in the early days.
So hiring is the only way you scale. I think that too many founders, including myself in many areas, still to this day, take on too much ourselves, don't delegate effectively, and that obviously prevents you from scaling. And so, you know, the job obviously early on is to really try and figure out, like, what are you going to be hopefully great at? Make sure you can hire for every other function and get yourself out of the way as much as possible. Make sure that you're not the sort of crutch that's holding up, you know, sales or growth or whatever, because that's not going to scale.
Let's talk a little bit about hiring a COO. I mean, that's a big decision, and it's a very controversial decision. There's a lot of people who would argue that it never works, and there's you know, others, like in your situation, they would say it's been hugely successful.
Okay.
So tell me a little bit about the thought process,
yeah,
both about hiring a COO and then specifically,
yeah,
what were you looking for when you hired?
Early on, so we're, again, 23 maybe at the time, and there was a juncture where it was like, can I be CEO of this company? And we had some conversations of like, am I going to be able to be CEO of this company? And I kind of thought about it like, well, I don't look like any of the CEOs that have scaled enterprise software companies. Usually way more sales experience, obviously older, more gray hair when I had brown hair. And now obviously it's effectively completely gray. So now I'm fully a gray hair vet of this industry. But early on didn't sort of look like the enterprise software CEOs that were typical at the time. And so I asked myself, like, is this going to work? And talked to some people and ultimately concluded, like actually, I really do want to do this. I'm going to get hopefully good at it. And I'm going to try and bring a unique skill of the product side to this. And I'm going to try and get everything else that we just as a company don't have enough time to learn, I'm going to try and have somebody else solve that. And that's like the company building, general management part of the business. I need somebody else who can run with that I'm not going to slow down. Like just HR, finance, operations, all of the things where we need more leadership on, we need somebody that can go do that. So interviewed a bunch of people. Fortunately was able to first get Dan on our board of directors and then eventually convince him to be COO. He was doing a sort of sabbatical, kind of early retirement thing, and convinced him that it would be more fun to be in the trenches. And so he joined.
How big was the company at that point?
About 40 employees, maybe around there, 35, 40 employees. And he came in and
it was very early.
Very early, very early. And I have huge respect for founders that you know can scale to hundreds of people without that kind of delegation, but. Shoot, if we had hired two more people, I think the company would have fallen apart. I was not good at like anything operational, like processes, systems, hiring, firing, all of that stuff, I'm not good at. I'm good at like looking at a product design and saying like we should do that or we should go in a different direction.
And was that hard to acknowledge and even to yourself?
No. And here's how. You basically measure the things that you enjoy doing. If you don't find joy in it, get rid of it. I basically said, I don't find joy in 80% of my job right now. And so probably I need to get rid of that somehow, and I need to only do the things that I'm actually going to be, you know, good at. It was very easy for me to let go of those things. The only thing that was hard was like, okay, is this going to work culturally? Do we have the right way of sharing responsibilities and separating responsibilities? That was the trickier part, but it was so obvious that this had to happen. I was going to fuck up the company if not.
Well, you know, it's amazing. You know, it sounds obvious in hindsight, but it's a really hard decision to make. So hats off to you for doing it.
Well, thank you. I think that the hard part is finding the person that works within your culture and that you personally can align with, because this is a relationship more than anything else. Because that's where it gets screwed up over time.
Let's talk about culture then.
Yeah.
What is your culture and how did you define that?
Yeah, so our culture got defined over about a year period, and we kind of looked at the things that we were doing without knowing that we were doing it, and we sort of said, how do we want to codify that and reinforce it as we scale the company? And we kind of looked at, okay, there's a bunch of qualities that we think we have that we'd like to really get good at and make sure we're honing. And you know, some things that you would expect from all companies, like be very customer-centric. In our case, we said we want to blow our customers' minds. We want to be the best partner that they've had. And so customer centricity became really core to us. Moving quickly and being able to hopefully be able to move faster than your traditional enterprise software company. So getting shit done, taking risks, but then failing quickly when those risks are you know, maybe not working out was a big part of the culture. We have this value of 10x it. And the idea obviously came from early on, you know, Andy Grove, and then into other folks of this idea of, you know, the best innovation really is when you have some kind of 10x advantage in cost and performance, and that's ultimately the only reason the customer cares is you're 10 times better than what they were doing previously. So we said, like, how do we make sure that from an innovation standpoint, we're always finding the points of 10x leverage that we create for the customer or from a technology standpoint. And then a bunch of ways we wanted to think about internally the way that we worked together. So be able to bring your whole self to work. So be able to create an environment where you can be authentic, where we don't have politics. And then one that's been incredibly important, especially over the past, you know, 2-5 years, as the Valley has sort of gone through a bunch of issues, is a value that we had kind of going back 8 or 9 years ago of make mom proud. So build a culture where you build a healthy, you know, workplace and environment where people have high integrity, and we work well together, and we create a, you know, safe environment, and that's been, you know, unbelievably important as we've scaled the business.
And was there a point in time when you consciously codified these, or did they evolve naturally? And one day you woke up and said, "This is our culture."
We actually literally just ran the process of like, what are our values? Because if we're going to go and hire 1,000 people, and that was probably the most number of people we could imagine hiring at the time.
And how big were you at the time?
100 people maybe. And we sort of said, okay, if we're going to like go 10x the business, there's a lot of people that are going to be coming here, and we have to have a framework that says, this is what we do, this is how we do it, this is how we behave, this is how we treat each other. These are the people that get promoted, these are the people that get fired. And at first I was actually, this was in the category of that the sort of, you know, naive first time founder. I was like, this seems like Dilbert stuff. Like you always see, like, okay, there's a wall of posters and they always say the same things. I wasn't skeptical, but I was like not the biggest champion of the process. I was like, okay, this is just what companies do. It's an HR thing, exactly. I gotta check the box. And then a couple years in, it became more and more obvious. Like, holy shit! Like you're bringing in so many more people. They come from so many other different cultures, and who's to say that they? Who knows whether how they're making decisions are in line with our values or not, and consistent with where we're trying to take the company in our environment. And so then it was like, oh, like I had more of an epiphany, which is like, oh shit, like everything is your values and everything has to funnel through this. And your performance system and your performance review process, how you hire, how you fire, how you celebrate outcomes in the business, who you decide to spotlight and when you decide to spotlight work. And so I became a massive convert, which is like, oh shit, like your values are everything. And if the moment you stop living by them is the moment you don't really have a culture, you don't really have a unified company. And I think we've seen, obviously, examples of companies that sort of lose that. Or maybe they always had values, but they weren't the values that could create a healthy environment that could
scale. Or they didn't live the values.
Values.
They were a piece of paper.
So at the moment of the interview process, we try and assess for, do people have the characteristics or traits that seem to align to people that will live these values? The first day of your onboarding as an employee, we go through the values and why they're important and how they get realized. I do 90% of those trainings for new hires. And then throughout your sort of life at Box, whether it's you know, how we talk about different decisions we make as a business, whether it's, again, a performance review, whether it's our internal talent enablement and manager enablement, all of that gets done through our 7 core values, you know, plus a couple other general things that you would expect. And because of the pervasiveness of the values, it becomes actually really obvious when somebody's not living that value. And then you just decide, like, how big is the infraction? Like, if it's like, okay, like, somebody's being overly bureaucratic or consensus, that's not GSD, like, we'll just have a conversation. We'll say, like, how do we move faster in this area? That's not, no one's gonna get fired for that. Versus if it's something where it's like, oh, like, we're not creating a healthy culture in that area, you know, that might be a more serious issue that we have to deal with.
And have there been situations where you had to make a choice between your values and short-term performance?
There's been times where that has been an obvious trade-off, and we've always sided on the side of values.
Is there a story you can share on that?
Not really. But what I would just say in general with values is that those are the ultimate tests, right? Yeah. It's like we're going to lose. We have revenue at stake, you know, because of a thing. It's more, you know, core to our values to have a different kind of decision get made. And so that's when you're ultimately tested.
We'll be right back.
If Albert Einstein had worked in human resources instead of quantum physics, he would have said that hiring is hard. Not as hard as the general theory of relativity, but way harder than the special theory of relativity. I mean, come on. It would have been obvious to an HR professional as brilliant as Einstein that getting the best people is the difference between being a great company and a mediocre one. That's why Einstein would have loved Eightfold. Eightfold is the most effective way for companies to identify promising candidates, engage talent, reach diversity goals, and retain top performers. Businesses using Eightfold's talent intelligence platform have been able to achieve 7 times higher candidate responses, 80% faster hiring cycles, and 60% lower cost to hire. That's why Eightfold would have been Einstein's favorite talent management tool, and that's why it should be yours too. Eightfold improves hiring. Visit eightfold.ai to learn more.
So one of the other things that's hard for enterprise founders is this notion of, do I have product market fit? Am I ready to scale? Do you have a point of view on what is product market fit and how do you decide how hard to step on the gas? Or was it obvious for you in the early days?
I think that because we didn't even know about product market fit when we were building the company, I think to me, I still only understand it from a purely academic standpoint. I think if I think about it as just as a product manager, it's like, it's really simple. Like, are you building something that people want to use? And are there a lot of those people and do you have a way to get to them? It's like, and then that's it. And your customers are going to give you feedback. And that feedback will either be like, holy shit, this thing's amazing. Or it'll be like, holy shit, it's not amazing, but it could be if you built these 2 things. Or it might be, holy shit, this thing could be amazing, but you need to build 32 things. And like somewhere on that continuum, you either are in a position where you can go scale, or you're in a position where you've really got a lot more work to do to be able to go solve the problem. And that's kind of how I think about it, which is like, are you clear on the problem you're trying to solve? And do you have the complete solution to do that? And obviously, somewhere between minimally viable and not embarrassing is like the point where you then bring it to market and then you start to scale your company and your product.
Makes sense. In the last couple of minutes that we have, I'm going to switch gears to sort of talking a little bit about what it's like to be a public company.
Cool.
You know, can you talk a little bit about the benefits of being public versus private?
Yeah.
That's the dream for every founder. I want to take my company public.
Oh, really? It's just not it was never a dream. So I'm very pro being public as opposed to being private, but at the right time. The benefits you get as being a public company, I think, are actually pretty enormous, which is it creates a high degree of transparency and scrutiny, and that's a really good thing because when you have almost unlimited access to venture capital, that means that you have you don't have to be as clear on your trade-offs. You don't have to be as clear on your performance. You don't have to make the hard decisions that actually are really good decisions. They're just hard, it forces you to actually build a better business model that ultimately makes you a much bigger company in the long run. And so now each company goes through a different point, and we raised hundreds of millions of dollars because we had to get to enough scale that could sort of go to a large Fortune 500 enterprises and say, we can be your backbone for managing your information. And only at that point could we then get to 100 million, 150 million in revenue, which is around the time that we went public. So now that we're public, the benefits are your customers then have way more transparency into you, which is a good thing because now we don't have as much of the, when you're 50 million in revenue, we literally had like business viability assessments on behalf of large customers.
Yep.
We don't do business viability assessments. As a cash flow positive company at 600 million in revenue, people understand like, okay, this is a real company I can buy software from. So that's a huge benefit. It's obviously a benefit to employee liquidity, and it's a benefit again to just the operational rigor that comes with being a public company. And then the biggest downside obviously is that you do make decisions between, can I make a 5-year investment in this area versus I have to make a 6-month investment in that area. And you have less capital to work with often for the longer term investments because those will be dilutive to your performance. And private investors, obviously, they're more amenable to those dilutive investments that will pay off in the long run. Public market is less so. So I think you just have to get really good at being very clear on what are the key investments you have to make to win, and then I think that's a really good trade-off and kind of allocation process. But it does mean that you're not always investing in as much as you'd like.
That makes a ton of sense. One of the things for most enterprise entrepreneurs these days is with the way Amazon has been executing and the way Google sort of been expanding its footprint in the enterprise, and Microsoft is finally seems to have got its shit together.
Yeah.
A lot of enterprise investors are in the same, enterprise entrepreneurs are feeling the same heat that consumer entrepreneurs have felt for the last 5-7 years,
yep.
Which is, do I really have a chance to compete with these platforms? You have successfully competed for a decade. So what advice do you have?
I think I think the advice actually follows the consumer market as well, which is you really have to ask yourself, are you a feature of a broader platform? And does that broader platform already have all the distribution and scale that it would need to then, the moment that they turn on a feature, you're kind of wiped out? And unfortunately, a lot of companies, we as, either product managers or engineers or entrepreneurs, we can sort of spot these small little annoyances in the world and say, well, shit, you could build an entire company on solving that annoyance. The problem is that if that annoyance is merely a gap in somebody else's product and not in its own category in and of itself, then that annoyance, once you prove that it can be solved, the incumbent that created that annoyance will just solve it. And so it's really like, are you solving an annoyance or is it a sufficient gap in the market where an entire new category of technology needs to emerge?
So you're spot on. The question is, it's not obvious.
Yeah.
Very often. Which
is why it's better to be a VC than an entrepreneur. Because as a VC, I get to have a portfolio of some are going to be annoyances, some will be categories. I don't know which ones. And as an entrepreneur, you better hope to hell you're not in the annoyance category, that you're actually in the category. And I think that I don't know the algorithm that tells you in advance which one is which. There are general principles, which is like, how hard is it going to be for somebody to solve? Do you have something that's extremely proprietary? Is there a reason that the incumbent wouldn't want to do what you're doing? Is there a different business model associated with it? Is there another factor or variable like you're more open than the incumbent can be for whatever reason? Or you can go deeper in that space than the incumbent could justify based on their DNA as an organization? Could it be more vertical and everybody else is horizontal? So I would say that the best way to think about it is like if you can, sort of, if that annoyance can expand to a category and you think that the defining characteristics of that annoyance going to a category are things that a disruptor insurgent can uniquely solve for versus the incumbent quickly fast following, then you've got a business. And I think what we've seen in the consumer space is there's a lot of companies that are like, well, Facebook Messenger has this one problem. So we built a company, and it's like, well, Facebook Messenger can just add that button, and then you're out of business. And so the enterprise software...
We're
seeing that. And in the enterprise software market, the exact same thing. If you're building something that is just a small little annoyance that Amazon Web Services has today, unless somehow miraculously you get to 10 million developers and then quickly pivot that into a giant platform, you're not going to go in... That won't be sustainable. Now, doesn't mean that you can't get great M&A as a result of that. There's a great argument for, you know, going and building a product in a space where people aren't looking at today, ultimately just be acquired by that incumbent. You know, then you've just done R&D for them, which can be great on both sides. But it might be harder to build the next Salesforce if that's your approach.
That's it for this episode. You can find past episodes and subscribe to future ones on iTunes, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. How to B2B a CEO is brought to you by Foundation Capital, an early stage venture capital firm with 27 IPOs, including Netflix, Lending Club, TubeMogul, and Sunrun. I'm Ashu Garg, a general partner at Foundation Capital. I'm passionate about helping B2B entrepreneurs who are trying to solve hard problems. So if this podcast speaks to you, if you are interested in growing from a technical founder into a business leader, drop me a line. Thanks, and see you next time.